it takes, just like a woman. Yes, she does, and she makes love just like a woman, and she aches just like a woman, but she breaks.
Ah, Nina Simone. But no, it's not Nina Simone's birthday, but the man who wrote that song, it is his birthday. It's Bob Dylan's birthday, who wrote some of the great music of my generation for this entire country, one of the people we remembered forever. Well, he's still alive. I remember him forever in terms of his music and what he contributed to our society, and also the covers. People turned his covers into some of the most amazing music, and Nina Simone is one of those who turned it just tastes just like a woman into this incredible piece. He did a wonderful job, too, but... I mean, Nina.
I'm sure you couldn't do it like Nina.
So we want to happy birthday, Bob Dylan. You have every album you've ever done, every book ever written, and all your covers. One of my favorite singer-songwriters in history. So happy birthday, Bob Dylan. But also today in history, as before we start our show, today in history, on the night of May 24th, 1856, is when John Brown and his company of Free State Volunteers began a war to attack pro-slavers in Kansas after they burned down Lawrence, Kansas, which was an anti-slavery stronghold, and led to the Pottawatomie Creek disaster, some people called it, when he took on the pro-slavery Law and Order Party. Five people were killed. Some say he murdered them in cold blood. It was the beginning of a war to end slavery led by John Brown. That took place today, May 24th, 1856. This is also, as we've been covering every day almost, and there's a story about it, May of 1961, when some of us were sitting in the mud at Resurrection City, Freedom Riders, I mean, years at the same time, maybe years later, earlier, Freedom Riders in 1961 were in Mississippi and Alabama. And on this day, May 24th, 1961, two buses carrying 27 Freedom Riders, 22 black folks, two whites, or as they put it in those days, 25 Negroes and two whites, were arrested by city police officers in Jackson for violating the law by coming in to that town because we were riding integrated on a bus. It was a time when people were beaten, tortured, burned, imprisoned. The Freedom Riders opened America's eyes to segregation, white America's eyes, I should say, to segregation and to ending segregation in that battle. And also on this day, May 24th, this did happen during Resurrection City, that's what I meant, that the French erupted, French young people and workers erupted to take over the government, to stop the war in Vietnam, to stop the oppression of working and poor people in France. And it was a huge eruption. People actually thought a revolution was in the making in France at that moment. It changed the course of many things. And this was also the day in 1883, I'll just tell you a little tidbit. The U.S. in Brooklyn, the Brooklyn Bridge was opened on this day in 1883.
Were you there?
I was there. Were you there?
No.
You're going to be there, right?
Definitely so.
But that's what happened on this day, May 24th, around, no, I was not there yet. And my family wasn't here yet. So
actually, my family was here.
Yeah, was here.
My family
here.
Was here. But you mentioned both Bob Dylan and the Freedom Riders in 1961. I have to constantly remind myself, since I've come here to Morgan, that many of the people I'm meeting here, many of the students I'm meeting here, for them, this is ancient history.
Yes, it is.
So I'm kind of glad that you bring history up
every day. Start with a little history every day on the show. So now we're going to talk about President Barack Obama's speech yesterday to the nation, analyze that and other things going around in Washington, D.C., the voice you just heard in the studio with us, E.R. Shipp. Shipp, of course, journalist in residence and associate professor of journalism here at Morgan State University. And in studio as well as Tyrone Keyes, author, public affairs strategist, public relations expert, whose work can be found at realityneversleeps.com. Always good to have you back.
Thank you. Good to be here, Mark.
He's not doing that. He's a volunteer medic in the fire department. Rouge Alawazir is with us. She is a Yemeni-American organizer and activist, currently organizing with Code Pink, co-founder of the Support Yemen Media Collective. And Rouge, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Amara Jones is with us once again, the economic justice contributor to ColorLines.com, served in the Clinton White House, where he worked on international trade policy. And Amara, welcome back. Always good to have you.
Thanks for having me and talking to you from Brooklyn.
From Brooklyn, there you go, across the bridge.
It's all linked.
410-319-8888 is the number here. You can join us here also at steinershow@gmail.com. Write in your thoughts. Some people have already written in last night on our Facebook pages. You can jump over there as well. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner and join in this conversation. 410-319-8888. So I think that this is an interesting speech that that President Barack Obama gave. People weren't quite sure what was coming up, but he covered Guantanamo. He covered drones and justifying the drone policy from his perspective in the United States, and which was a. And then he talked a lot about how he's going to really switch policy and took on Republicans in terms of closing Guantanamo and open the door for Yemeni prisoners in Guantanamo to go back. Some saying it was not enough. Some saying that you shouldn't be closing Guantanamo and we should not be releasing any of these people. So just a quick overview, all your perspectives for just a couple minutes each about what you think this meant, this speech last night meant. And Imara, why don't we start with you?
Well, I think, like a lot of speeches that he gives, it's, you know, a lot of times when you listen to the president, it's like being at a fantastic concert where during it you're humming along and going crazy, and then the next day you wake up at home and you struggle to remember exactly what the song is. and I think that we're in a little bit of that, because I think that when you look at substantively what has changed yesterday to today, there's not that much. In the drone strike program had already been on the glide path that he had laid out. There'd already been talk that it was going to move away from the CIA to the military. I think the biggest thing about the drone program is that he talked about it at all. I don't know if everyone sort of plugged into the fact, but 4 years ago, the White House wasn't even acknowledging that the drone strike program exists. They weren't acknowledging, this is President Obama, wasn't acknowledging that the president was involved in making the decisions. This was a total black ops operation, and the only way that the program was acknowledged was because of the results abroad that were then funneled back to the United States, but not because the government acknowledged it. So that's a huge change. Guantanamo, not that big of a change. There are 166 people there. 86 of them have been cleared for release. He won't release them because of the restrictions that he places on himself. Yesterday, he said that he would consider releasing them if other conditions now were met, so that hasn't really changed. I think in a lot of ways, it's not that big of a difference from today to yesterday. What was important is the rhetoric. What was important was the acknowledgement, but substantively, and with respect to even limits on presidential power, which he said that's a change, but didn't necessarily specify what those changes should be and how they should come about, I don't know.
Ship?
Well, I think it was an important speech for those reasons you just said. I think what it gave the president a chance to do was to seem to be out front and open to the American public at a time when his administration is being challenged for being too secretive, perhaps abusing powers. I'm specifically talking about the IRS scandal right now. But there's questions still about the competency in foreign policy. There are hearings concerning what happened in Libya and Benghazi. So the administration has been on the defense for quite a while now. And this is a chance for Obama to try to seem that he is in control and to get ahead of the game a little bit.
Tyrone
Keyes. Yeah, I actually agree with a lot of what ER just said. I think that the substance of the speech is stuff that we have heard before. There were no real specifics in it. However, the timing of the speech gave the president an opportunity to soak up some of the media oxygen from some of the other things that are going around, specifically the IRS issue, because, I mean, let's face it, you've got a government official who, by the way, refuses to resign, taking the fifth. This is stuff that we've seen from major mafiosos in the past. Then she has the audacity to refuse to resign. So this is an opportunity for the administration to soak up some of that media oxygen, especially as we go into this long holiday weekend. One note that has not gotten a lot of attention that I did personally find very enlightening was when the president said he came out and gave the realization that this is a different war but that wars must end. He made mention to that fact. And I was very...
Well, this war must end, he was saying.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And I was very happy to hear him say that, because we've had nebulous wars, ongoing wars in the past, not militaristic, but the war on poverty, the war on drugs, that have turned into these big leviathans that are never ending. So for the president to bring the realization that this is a different war, but it is a war that we have to also prosecute differently and look toward an end, I did like that aspect of the speech.
Rouge?
Actually, on that point, I think the president, what he did was just use his basic general terms like we're at war with Al-Qaeda and associated forces. What does that even mean? Using words like imminent threat still. So we're still seeing the same use of language that's very general. It's great that he's acknowledging, but I didn't see enough of clarity or definitions being made to anything he said. I feel as though he justified the drone wars all from a classical imperialist and orientalist perspective.
So let me just push a little bit here on some of the things that we heard the president say. Why don't we queue up while we're looking for that one, the one thing we want to play in a moment here. Let's click up, pick up clip three, okay? Oversight. Let's go to oversight and just hear some of the words of the president and then come back.
Now going forward, I've asked my administration to review proposals to extend oversight of lethal actions outside of war zones that go beyond our reporting to Congress. Each option has virtues in theory, but poses difficulties in practice. For example, the establishment of a special court to evaluate and authorize lethal action has the benefit of bringing a third branch of government into the process, but raises serious constitutional issues about presidential and judicial authority. Another idea that's been suggested, the establishment of an independent oversight board in the executive branch, avoids those problems but may introduce a layer of bureaucracy into national security decision-making without inspiring additional public confidence in the process. But despite these challenges, I look forward to actively engaging Congress to explore these and other options for increased oversight.
Oh, okay, and more quicker than I thought. Sorry. So sometimes when I hear parts of the speech like this, Ship, I'm not sure what he's telling us that we don't already know.
Well, when you say what we don't already know, keep in mind that a lot of people don't know any of this stuff. Some people don't obsess on this the way they are. They're more interested in who's winning The Voice or something, perhaps. So this is new to a lot of people who take the time to listen to the president's speech. That particular clip shows President Obama being Professor Obama. He's laying out various options, not telling you where he's leaning exactly or that he's actually committed to any of the options. But he's laying them out there. This is the pro and the con as he sees it, and leaving it to Congress to take the next step.
Yeah, I agree that for the time being, we're still struggling with the fact that this is the first kind of war we've seen that's borderless and boundaryless. So there's still a lot of questions. And again, just to reiterate, you did hear the administration's pontification process, if you will. They have no clear answers on how this should be prosecuted. However, they do understand that it does need to come out of the White House. This process needs to come outside the Oval Office, having one person accountable for, in particular, these drone strikes.
Go ahead, Imar.
I mean, I wish it was even as Ship described, right? I wish that it was a laying out of options. What he said was that he was going to set up a process that would then lay out the options that would then be reviewed, that he would then look at. And I think that this is one of his key problems, quite frankly, if I can just be so blunt about it, that job, particularly as commander-in-chief of a global armed force, is a deciding job. It's not an administrative job. And consequently, it's interesting that he says that action is a review. Action is not a review. And this is my point about the speech generally, that substantively, not politically, perhaps politically, as people are saying, and not necessarily communications-wise, which is another point that people are making wise, but I'm making a point substantively, and there wasn't that much in it. And there wasn't that much different today than there was yesterday. And that given the fact that the war on terrorists goes to the very heart of who we are as a country and our and what our ideals are about. This isn't a country that's based on ideas and ideals. And ideals about human value and human worth and how we make those decisions. And the fact that this is at the very heart of that, and that a lot of the actions that we've had in the war on terror have had us bend back on the most cherished ideals that we have as a country, means that action is what's needed, not necessarily reviews. And this is not this is a very key issue.
So what do we mean by action? I mean, if you let's listen to this one piece of our tape. This is what happened when Medea Benjamin stood up and spoke from the audience, who, by the way, will be a guest on the show next Wednesday morning. But let's hear what happens here and talk about whether this is a difference in Obama and what they're saying in this administration or not.
There is no justification beyond politics for Congress to prevent us from closing a facility that should have never been opened. Today, so let me finish, ma'am.
Good.
So today, once again,
today. People.
I'm about to address it, ma'am, but you got to let me speak. I'm about to address it.
Commander-in-Chief.
Let me address it.
Close Guantanamo today.
Why don't you let me address it, ma'am?
Those 86 prisoners.
Why don't you sit down and I will tell you exactly what I'm going to do.
Today, that includes 57 Yemenis.
Thank you, ma'am.
It includes Shakir Amr.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ma'am, thank you. You should let me finish my sentence. Today, I once again call on Congress to lift the restrictions on detainee transfers from Gitmo. I have asked the Department of Defense to designate a site in the United States where we can hold military commissions. I'm appointing a new senior envoy at the State Department and Defense Department whose sole responsibility will be to achieve the transfer of detainees to third countries. I am lifting the moratorium on detainee transfers to Yemen so we can review them on a case-by-case basis. To the greatest extent possible, we will transfer detainees who have been cleared to go to other countries. Where appropriate, we will bring terrorists to justice in our courts and our military justice system. And we will insist that judicial review be available for every detainee.
All right. This was the piece with Medea in it. I want you to kind of look at our listeners here. I mean, our listeners who join us at 410-319-8888 and ask our guest. I mean, what was substantially different about what he said, both in terms of Guantanamo, Yemeni prisoners? Was it substantially that different? Let's go to Rouge first. We haven't heard from Rouge in a minute. Then we'll come over. Rouge?
Yeah, I think it was great for him to acknowledge it, but, you know, that he's been acknowledging it since the very beginning. I think the most troubling thing here is he once again called on Congress to lift the restrictions on detainee transfers, despite the fact that he has the power to order the Secretary of Defense to issue waivers that would allow prisoners to go home. Also, I think another troubling factor is he made no promise to discontinue the practices of indefinite detention or military commissions. So I think these are like key issues, key underlying issues of Guantanamo Bay prison that he failed to acknowledge. And I don't know what he means by reviewing case-by-case basis of the cleared for release. So, you know, we might see maybe just one transfer of the 86 cleared for release. We might see 20 cleared for release. And will they be able to go back to Yemen, a country that's been willing and outspoken for their prisoners to come back home? So, I mean, he left a lot of unanswered questions. Again, no clarity of what his new plans for closing Guantanamo Bay means and indefinite detention in general.
And can I just say that what's interesting is that there's already been a case-by-case review. that the military itself has reviewed each one of these cases and has already decided that they should be cleared for review. This is what I'm saying. To the extent possible, on a case-by-case basis, that's already been included in the process of the review. And that 86 of the 166 should, according to the military's own assessment of the threats to the United States, should be allowed to go home. And that this is totally in the president's purview. This is totally in the president's writ. And as Medea was saying, she was shouting, but she was absolutely right. She said, you could do this today. You could do this right now. And I think that that's a part of the curiosity. The Constitution gives the president broad authority on war-making powers, far more than the Congress does, that there are a lot of things that in it, even in it above what he laid out yesterday, he could do to turn the situation around. And let's be clear that one of the reasons why 30 of the prisoners right now at Guantanamo Bay are close to death is because of the hunger strike that was prompted by the fact that they've lost hope that they're ever going to get out and go home.
Well, I certainly don't agree with the sympathetic view that seems to be taking hold with regard to the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay.
You do not have sympathy for the prisoners at Guantanamo
Bay. I do not. I do not. And I understand the president's difficult position. I will say this. It is a bit disingenuous of him to claim that Congress is the point that's stalling him from doing anything with the prisoners. If he has taken broad executive action on his own on several domestic issues, and combine that with the fact that right after he won his first election to become president of the United States, he had a Congress and he had Senate and a House that was Democrat. So he could have certainly made that move then. It was one of his major campaign planks at the time. So it's a little disingenuous this time to say, well, you know, it's all Congress's fault that I can't get this done.
He's also indicating, it seems, from the way I was quickly reading the papers this morning, it seems he's now saying he's able to take this executive action with more confidence because Yemen has a new president and they have more faith, perhaps, in the new regime there than they did before. So he's using that as his...
I find it difficult to believe that a change in administration from the previous president in Yemen to a new president will take them off of the state-sponsored terrorism list and get rid of those factions within the country that are sympathetic to al-Qaeda.
A couple of things. First of all, Yemen itself, the country, the government's not on the state-sponsored terrorism list.
Well, it has been.
They've been a long-time ally since what, 2002 of the United States. That's the first thing.
I would dispute that. Are you familiar with the Cole incident?
The second thing is, since that was a different regime.
But it was the same country.
There are 86 prisoners right now that have been cleared by the military as no longer a threat to the United States that can be cleared for transfer to go home. That's not about sympathy. That's about national security, and that's a national security fact established by the military. 56 of those are Yemenis. That means that 30 could have already gone home. So even if we buy everything that you've said, there's still a substantial number of people that the military says should not be there anymore that are there, and no one can give a legitimate reason.
The military has not said they should not be
there
anymore. The military has said that they are open to review.
No, actually,
they have not said that they should be there.
They've already been reviewed. These 86 cases have already been reviewed by the military, and they have made a case-by-case assessment. They are no longer a threat.
All right, well, then I stand corrected on that. But
everyone, we have to go breaking. Come right back. We'll continue the discussion here. More clips. We're talking, joined about the president's speech yesterday, 410-319-8888. Join us. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are here covering what happened with President Barack Obama and his speech yesterday. Lines are open at 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. I'm going to jump on the Facebook here. I see that people are writing on Facebook. You can also join us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And we are joined by E.R. Shipp, journalist in residence and associate professor of journalism here at Morgan State University, and a Pulitzer Prize winner in 1996. Tyrone Keyes, author, public affairs strategist, and public relations expert, whose work can be found at realityneversleeps.com. Rouge Al-Wazir, a Yemeni-American organizer and activist, currently organizing with Code Pink, co-founder of Support Yemen Media Collective. and Imara Jones, economic justice contributor to colorlines.com, who served in the Clinton White House where he worked on international trade policy. Number here is 410-319-8888. And you were making a point as we're going to break, Tyrone.
Yeah, one of the points I was making was about the recidivism rate, which is pretty substantial for the people that get out of Guantanamo Bay and return to the battlefield, so to speak. So now I want to draw a clear line here that there is no sympathy from me. I do understand that the president's primary task is protecting the American citizen, and he's dealing with that with information that we obviously may not be privy to. But no, I'm not sympathetic to that individual that will go and take up arms against the United States again after they're released. Now, having said that, I do find the practice of rendition to be outside of what we as Americans would have as a process in terms of just snatching people off of the street and detaining them for God knows how long in, you know, God knows where. So, yes, that is wrong. That doesn't give them an opportunity to be adjudicated. But other than that, no, there's no sympathy from me for these actors.
Ship, you want to jump in on that? Now I want to go to Rouge, and I have a question for her directly about that.
You can ask Rouge.
Rouge?
I'm
curious to hear your position on this.
I missed the
Well, you can address the rendition, the recidivism aspect of it. How many of these men go back to taking up arms against the United States of America after they have been released from detention?
Well, that's real.
I mean, we can see from experiences that people that have. I mean, we've already had 500 people go back to Yemen and Pakistan and the UK and Canada. And I've met people that have been transferred and are now either working for Al Jazeera or are engineers, lawyers, NGO workers. People, I mean, they're human beings just like us, and we need to give them a chance to rehabilitate and go back to normal life. It's not easy, of course, but we have to help them make that transfer over. I mean, we can't expect that, you know, they're going to go pick up arms again, and that's why we have to hold them indefinitely. I think that in itself is goes against who we are as American people, so it just doesn't make sense.
I mean, there are also two other issues. One, I mean, what's interesting is that there's an assumption that everyone at Guantanamo Bay who's there belongs there and has got there through legitimate means. 80% of the people who are there because of an award that the Americans put out earlier in the war for turn in a terrorist and you'll get X amount of dollars. And so a lot of people, as, you know, Mark, you were talking about before, this happened widely in tribal areas in Pakistan and Afghanistan, seized people and said this is a person who's a terrorist, and they turned them over and they ended up in Guantanamo Bay. Now, there's some that are legitimate and some that aren't. You know, some people who were 13 years old got seized and sent to Guantanamo Bay. And so I think that that's one of the things that we need to be aware of. And the second thing is whether there's a broader question in terms of Guantanamo Bay and our national security as to whether it's actually done more harm to the United States than good in terms of being a motivator, a propaganda tool that creates more terrorists than it actually is holding. There are 100 and now, 66 people there. I think a couple of thousand have passed through since the beginning of the war. It's an open question how many people have responded to it as a symbol against the United States. And so I think, one, not everybody who's there necessarily is there legitimately. Some are, some aren't. And secondly, whether or not it's actually creating more terrorists than it's actually resolving.
And looking at the stats, conservative journals like have said that there's a 25% recidivism rate. However, looking at other analysis of that, the Public Record, which is another online journal, says the rate is actually much lower than that. The rate is 15% or 95 who have been described as confirmed as reneging on and reengaging in the process, and 12% are described as suspected of reengaging, but they don't know. So the number is not 40%, it's not 30%, it's a whole lot lower than that. And so I'm sorry, you're going to say, Imara?
I was going to say, since when, by the way, do Americans go against our most cherished ideals because it's inconvenient? I mean, the entire process that we're engaged in of democracy and of spreading human rights in the United States and giving people a chance and all the things that we hold very dear is a very hard, very difficult, very messy, very inconvenient, very inefficient process. And we can't say that because it hits a bump in the road that all of a sudden all of those things go out the window.
You know, maybe, though, one of the significant things about the speech is that it gives us a baseline now for starting the clock against Obama to tackle some of these very issues. By virtue of his declaring that the old war on terrorism is ending and we need to go back to the way we were September 10th of 2001, in essence, when it comes to protecting constitutional rights and being vigilant about how the government acts towards its citizens and towards threats to the United States. I think now we know we're going to start from what he said yesterday on all of these points and then hold his feet to the fire.
Just a couple of things that were written on Facebook. Plato Hieronymus wrote in, strong speech after initially being stunned. He handled the interruption beautifully. Don Rojas, veteran journalist, former editor of Amsterdam News, among many other things, and Free Speech TV. He said, Obama handled Medea's protest deftly. Medea Benjamin's passion and activism on the drone issue, however, should not be naysayed. She is a person with the courage of her convictions. And I know she was on Democracy Now! She'll be on our show later this week. And I know you work with her, Rouge.
And most definitely, I'm really glad Medea was able to get in because I think she asked the most important questions that nobody dares to ask, that he keeps running away from, that he keeps denying, like the 16-year-old Abdelrahman Olaki, that he, even yesterday during the White House briefing at noon, when somebody tried to bring it up, again, he ignored it. So for him to, for Medea to bring it up when the whole world is watching was fantastic. I heard some people in Yemen finally connect with people in the U.S. saying, oh, okay, it's not all of America that one is dead, you know? So it was really inspiring to see Medea challenge Obama and ask questions like about the signature strike, the kill list. I mean, there are so many things that he completely disregarded in this war on terror and the drone wars in Yemen and Pakistan.
So let's talk about this for a moment. Well, let's talk about his analysis of the drone war and your response to that analysis that he gave about he gave a very lengthy, huge justification of American policy of using drones and of killing Americans who were overseas if they could not be captured any other way. He made it kind of, some people thought it was engaging and correct, other people said it missed the mark, but I'm curious what our guests perceive in their analysis of that drone. Who'd like to begin? Tyrone, go ahead.
I don't have much consternation with the way that President Obama has prosecuted the drone war. I think that he has actually... He has killed more terrorists than any other president using that technology, and that's fine by me. I think that when it comes to collateral damage, however, I think that there are steps that need to be taken to prevent that. Robert Gibbs made a despicable statement at one point when asked about the son of a terrorist who was killed in a drone strike. And Gibbs said, well, he should have had a different father, which I thought was despicable and showed a total lack of respect for human life. So I'm hopeful that they can minimize the collateral damage as we go. Now, in terms of American citizens, if you have American citizens on American soil that are not engaged in any imminent threat, then they need to be prosecuted in a criminal court. In line with our Constitution. If you have Americans on foreign soil doing something that is not imminent, I would also say that they would need to be arrested and prosecuted, whether it be under military court or a civilian, who knows. But I'm uncomfortable with the killing of American citizens via drone without, you know, in the absence of an imminent threat.
Well, how are we going to know when there's an imminent threat? That's one of the tricky questions here. The president was leaving open his access to using drones in those circumstances where he says there's no other option, essentially, is what he's saying. So he's not saying he's going to stop the drone program at all. That's going to continue, but he's telling us that the targets will be selected better and that there will be all efforts made to lessen collateral damage, as the term is used, that is the killing of people who should not be killed, the killing of children and innocents in other ways. He said, and I'm quoting here, "Neither I nor any president can promise the total defeat of terror. We will never erase the evil that lies in the hearts of some human beings, nor stamp out every danger to our open society. But what we can do, what we must do, is dismantle networks that pose a direct danger to us and make it less likely for new groups to gain a foothold, all the while maintaining the freedoms and ideals that we defend." It's hard to do those two things, but he's saying he's going to try to get us back to protecting human rights and valuing those rights we've come to know as our constitutional rights. But he's still going to go after the bad guys.
Right.
One of the most disturbing things, though, that I have to say about the conduct of the drone wars is the international precedent that it set. It was fine for as long as the United States was the only country with drone technology. But now over a dozen countries in the world, some of whom we think are on our side and some who are not, or act in our interest, including Russia and now Hezbollah and Iran, all are investing in drone technology. And with the precedent that we've set in terms of the ability to be able to have a secret program that was not transparent, that did not abide by international law, in which people that we designated as threats to the United States were targeted for killing and wiped from the face of the earth, quite literally, as the precedent, is one that others will use. And increasingly, that will become very difficult for us. There was a recent case of China, I think it was in Thailand or somewhere in Southeast Asia, targeted a large drug dealer for assassination, and in part using a lot of the same arguments that we use on drone technology. Now, imagine when China and all of the other countries that I listed have drone technology, if they decide to use our precedent. And it's one of the reasons why the top lawyer for the UN today came out and said that it was refreshing that the president did give some transparency around the issue, because as we move forward, this is going to become a global international security issue.
And Rouge, you just came back from 7 months in Yemen, which has been under a lot of kind of drone surveillance and attacks. And I'd like you to give us a sense of what's happening and where the Yemeni people are, what the state is of all that is, from your perspective while you were there.
Yeah, when I first arrived in September of last year, and a week after I arrived, there was a drone attack in Al Majala village, south of the capital. And mainstream media immediately reported 10 suspected militants killed in a drone attack by the U.S. So my sister and I, she was a journalist, decided to go down south and see what happened. And what we found out was there was 21 women that had died, 19 children, and 9 injured. None of that reported in the news. And among all those people was one possibly linked Al-Qaeda member, not even a definite high-value targeted person, but a suspected militant that may be associated by Al-Qaeda. And therefore, all of these people had to die. Again, we saw the same thing happen in December, where mainstream media again reported that 5 Al-Qaeda members were killed. In reality, we saw, again, civilians dying as a result of a U.S. drone strike. And so that's the daily reality. I mean, people, and it's not even just about strikes in general. It's the people are living in deep fear. They're living under drones 24 hours, 7 days a week. The trauma that comes out of that, the fear, the psychologically, physically, everything. People don't talk about that. And also signature strikes. Obama issued allowed signature strikes. This means that anybody that looks suspicious of militant age, which is 16 years old and older, can be a target. in a country where the median age is 18 years old, and where the country is a second has the highest second per gun capita rate, everyone's going to be looked at as a militant, and so they're just killing away. I mean, that's a huge problem that we need to be discussing and admitting. So if you're talking about transparency, we need to start from the, you know, from the very basic thing about who we're killing and why we're killing them. So that's, I mean, that's the daily reality in Yemen.
No, I appreciate it. That's one of the reasons I wanted to hear from you about what you experienced and what you saw there. Let me just switch gears a little bit on this for a second. And Tyrone alluded to something in the very beginning of this conversation. And some people, especially in on the conservative end of the opposition to President Barack Obama, would say that part of this is great to have this Memorial Day weekend begins to kind of obfuscate and gloss over the things that Congress is investigating around the IRS and around Benghazi. Is there a there, or are there a no there's there? Ship?
What do you mean?
What do I mean by that? I mean, is there a there in these in the investigations of things like Benghazi or the IRS? Is it politics, or is there some substance here?
Well, it's great theater for those who like political theater, political theater of the absurd, we might call it. It seems to me, from what I've observed of the hearing so far, nothing is coming out of that that is not already known. Most of the information members of Congress are focusing on is information they've had at their disposal for quite some time. So what they're doing now is just putting on a show to try to make the Obama administration squirm as much as possible. But they're not bringing forth anything that we did not already know about either how the embassy operated in Benghazi or anything about the IRS necessarily.
Well, I would take issue Tyrone with the IRS things. Part of it. Yeah, because, look, let's be honest. We're talking about al-Qaeda and terrorism. But the organization that has the most influence over Americans out of those two, it's the IRS. Now, I would not encourage anyone in the listening audience to mess around with the IRS. Don't do what they're doing, okay? Don't go before them and claim you're going to plead the fifth. You can ask Lauryn Hill and Wesley Snipes how that'll end up. This is a big issue, and we need to find out who gave the orders to go in and create this process. This is a process complete with forms and, you know, all that good stuff. So I don't believe it was the president, because I think this is a smart administration. They gave him plausible deniability by not telling him anything about this. But there is a targeting mechanism that has the IRS going after people who disagree with the administration. And I think Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, we can all agree that we need to put a stop to that. And some people need to go to jail for it.
And Imara, I'm curious your take on this.
Right. I mean, I think two things. I think one... this happened under George Bush, and no one cared. When it was happening to left-leaning groups, I think it was Adam Schiff, who's a member of Congress from Washington, went and said, you know, getting all these complaints from left groups that people on the left, that they're being targeted by the Bush administration, by the IRS for politically motivated searches, and they went to the Republican-leaning Congress, and you could hear a pin drop. So the fact that this is now happening...
So we should let it go now. We should just forget about it now.
No one said that.
That's what you're saying, in essence.
But let Imara finish his thought.
I think the fact... So the fact that this is happening now, I think, is... It could easily be construed that it is part of a larger political theater. That's not to say that in all political theater there's not a kernel of substance. It's the way that the substance gets either expanded or contorted or abstracted from what its relative impact is. And if we lay out the entire array of things that the country is facing, an IRS in Cincinnati that went off the rails because of a poor administration, I think is not one of them.
So the IRS posing questions about what... are the content of your prayers is not a problem with you.
The second thing is...
Apparently not.
Wait, so please, Tyra, let me finish this thought.
My second point on this is, to me, one of the most interesting things, and this may seem unconventional, is it actually reflects to me the impact, the long-term impact of these budget and austerity and administration wars for a variety of reasons. The first of all is that one of the things that people have said who are in the government is that the entire debate over how much money they were going to have and constantly scaling back their budgets and doing a whole host of things has actually made it harder for them to run the government. It's made their ability, they only have a certain amount of hours of the day, and if you're engaged in figuring out how to totally reorganize because you're going to have a lot less money, you're not focused on actually how programs are running and what people are doing and actually running the government effectively, efficiently. This has been a long-term strategy of the starve the beast ideology, by the way, of Republicans, who have constantly said what we're going to do is to undermine the ability of the government to function. It will become inoperable and will collapse in on itself and will move on. Well, it did happen, but it happened in a way that is in a way that they did not expect and a way that they did not want. That, and I can easily see there were these reports that, you know, it was coming up to the White House that there was something that may have been awry in the IRS or. And I could easily see that you've got a number of things that you're dealing with, and you know, one office, as I said, going off the rails, or an IRS going off the rails. It's just not high up on the list. If you're Treasury Secretary, okay. If you're Jack Lew, given the fact that he's had to deal with taxes,
so in
the first three, he's had to deal with all these things. You don't have this isn't this. It's not a high priority given what's happening.
Well, let me suggest something. Maybe some people always overlook in this particular instance, and I think that it's part of what goes on here because the press doesn't get under stories very often, which is people should be questioning, I think, maybe whether or not there should even be 501c4s to start with. Mm-hmm. We don't know what they do. The fact that you can give to a political group and hide who you are. You know what? We always forget the historical roots of 501c4s. Anybody know what the historical root of 501c4s are? The historical root took place in the early 60s. We talked about this the other week on the show. The historical roots took place in Alabama when the segregationist forces in the South were trying to force the NAACP to release the names of the people in those states who gave money to the NAACP for fighting to end segregation. The American government said they didn't have to because clearly that would mean those people's lives were in danger. That's where this all started. And that's been that has morphed into a twisted corporate world that says now we can have the same right and we can give money to anybody we want and you can't say who's influencing government elections because we have the same rights as that. That's where 501c4s come from. Maybe they shouldn't exist at all.
Maybe they shouldn't, and that's definitely a debate that maybe we should have.
Maybe they're destroying our democracy. I mean, this is what the real fight is, and the problem is they're making it into a partisan anti-conservative fight when it's more than that.
Maybe they shouldn't exist. That's an argument we can have, but again, I stress, I don't care if you're liberal, Democrat, conservative, Republican, whatever. The IRS definitely has more influence over the lives of Americans than Al-Qaeda, and the powers that they have should be checked. They should not be allowed to run rampant. I don't care what administration you have, Republican, Democrat, whatever. It's wrong.
They have a tad too much power, though. Too many people and corporations not paying their taxes as well. But, Chip?
I think that's right. What was scary for me, because I hadn't really been focusing on this issue until the hearings, was the power that the IRS had to actually examine where you went to church, what books you read, who you talked to, all of those kinds of things, in an effort, it seems to me, only to harass political opponents. That's the scariest part of this whole thing. Whether these 501c4s should exist, yes, let's look at that. But you can't get around the fact that something very wrong, something very disturbing was happening in that Cincinnati office. And we don't know if it really was just a lone office going off the rail, as you say, or whether there are others who are cutting corners the same way.
And they do this to the trouble with the IRS is they do this. And people say you shouldn't know the IRS will come after you, but they've already done it once to me years and years back. And the experience was really overwhelming. They do come to your house. They do want to know what's in your library. They want to check everything around you, and it's completely intrusive what they do. They think one little thing is wrong with your thing. They say, oh, let's look at this guy's stuff or this woman's stuff. And I think that what they need to be doing is thinking about how we should reform our tax system, whether you believe in the right or the left. And I would take it from the left and you would take it from the right. I'm looking at Tyrone. But I'm saying we need to reform our tax system and deal with stuff. And what we're doing here is I think it's dangerous if you are, as one of our guests said on the show, Leonard Pitts, wrote in his column, even though they're attacking conservatives, people on the left and liberals should be saying, look, you know, this is something all of us should be concerned about because it's just not right. So, I mean, all that is real. And I think that I don't think President Barack Obama knew about this at all. I mean, it probably does not filter that high. Oh, my producer's got his finger in the air, which he's either lecturing me or telling me we have 1 minute left. He's telling me we have 1 minute left. So I want to thank all of our guests for being here today. Ruj Al-Wazir, it's great to have you with us. I look forward to having you back. Co-founder of Support Yemen Media Collective, currently organizing with Code Pink and a Yemeni-American organizer and activist. Once again by phone, Imara Jones, economic justice contributor to ColorLines.com, who served in the Clinton White House. Always great to have you with us, Imara.
Thanks for having me.
Tyrone Keyes, been a while since you've been with us. Author, public affairs strategist, public relations expert, whose work can be found at RealityNeverSleeps.com, which we will link to on our website.
Thank you, Mark.
And E.R. Shipp. Come to our studios once again, so it's great to have her with us, journalist in residence and associate professor of journalism here at Morgan State University, former ombudsman for the Washington Post, which did a really great job, and everybody has said that, and winner of the 1996 Pulitzer Prize. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about the unknown story about Guatemala coming back. Most press is not talking about, but then we jump into a conversation with Leonard Pitts, who I just mentioned, about his new book, Freeman. So don't go anywhere. Mark Steiner Show is coming right back.